you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Lamprey Milt back on the show. He is the host of MythGal Chats, MythGal Chats series, which you can find over on BitChute and MythGal.tv. He also writes for the American Sun, where you can find the article we're going to discuss tonight about the LA riots. LA Riots Revisited is the title. We'll be taking a closer look at that and the events leading up to that destructive event. How you doing tonight?
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's living in definitely some strange times, that's for sure.
You may think maybe I'll change the name of the show.
But I said to you just earlier before we went live, it's like living in a nursing home.
Everyone freshening to get a shot. Everyone's worried about their health. Everyone's become some hypochondriac.
it's unbelievable, to say the least. I wanted to do this topic for a change, just because get off the typical covangelical COVIDian topics that seems to be on everyone's mind these days, and kind of revisit the Los Angeles riots. I became fascinated with a few years ago during the whole Ferguson protest. And I heard so many people saying, oh, this is the worst it's ever been. Can you believe this, that, or the other that's on that's floating around social media? Mm-hmm. Obviously, people uploading 30-second videos of some type of beating, something on fire. And I thought it was a little bit strange because I feel that in the United States, we're being habituated to have a much lower tolerance for violence. So whenever someone kept mentioning that this is the worst it's ever been, or even during the St. Floyd protest last year, people saying that they've never seen such destruction, I was like, no, I don't think this is the worst it's ever been. And that's when I started doing a little bit of research on rioting in the United States. And the one that obviously stands out the most is what happened on April 29th, 1992, the LA riots, the Rodney King beating. And there's some really good information out there, not on the internet. You have to read some books that were written right after that eventful day. And I was trying to see if there was some form of subversion elements to it, to see if perhaps there were agitators, instigators. And doing this research, I've come to realize that, you know, sometimes things just happen. Shit happens, let us say. And it turns out that a lot of it is just really a feud, a squabble at the higher pillars of our society. And that's what I wanted to really get into tonight.
Well, it is kind of topical because we now we live right now with the ever-present threat of a riot, you know, because of some event or some arrest someone's resisting arrest, someone gets tased or shot.
Well, it's every day now.
Yeah, so there, it becomes a pretext or an excuse for a mostly peaceful protest, as they say. So it's just something that – a good example, we had the Derek Chauvin trial where he was convicted on all counts. And, of course, I guess the cloud hanging over the jury was a threat of a riot. And now it's kind of assumed or thought – that one of the reasons why they did convict Derek Chauvin on all counts is they didn't want a riot, you know. And, you know, some commentators even said that they're glad that he was convicted because they didn't want their city to burn again, you know.
Right, so, they didn't want a repeat of the L.A. riots. And I was quite shocked that it went in the direction it did, given the circumstances surrounding St. Floyd's drug test, you know, when they did the coroner's report and such. I was expecting, because look, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. And when I saw this whole thing with George Floyd, and we're at the end of the month of April, right? So I was like, wow, this really seems to coincide with what happened 29 years ago. So
yeah. And obviously, yeah, you had medical examiner's report, the testimony, even of the prosecution's witnesses testified that George Floyd was ingesting large amounts of drugs just prior to his arrest. And of course, the thinking is that he was arrested, and of course, because he was arrested for passing the counterfeit $20 bill, he swallowed his stash and overdosed, and that's what killed him. But nevertheless, the knee on the back of his his back near his neck killed him. And of course, all the defense had to do was present a reasonable doubt. That's the threshold. And of course, how can you not have reasonable doubt with all that evidence? And nevertheless, this was a political verdict. And again, it was measured justice. It wasn't equal justice, as Kamala Harris said, and just the beginning. And the whole media has said there's more work to be done. No one has specified exactly what that work is, but I guess it's just this ever-present threat of ongoing turmoil, unrest, and revolution is what they would create, a political condition where there's constant flux, unrest, you know.
Well, the Rodney King beatings set a precedence in the United States. Now, you can talk about the Watts riots, the riots in Detroit. You sent me a great article about what happened in 01 in Cleveland, but it seems to be always under the guise of what the police are doing. Mm-hmm. It seems that we have to police the police, not police crime. And that seemed to be something that was echoed back in the early 1990s. I want to clarify a couple of things, because we seem to start getting a little bit lost in the sauce regarding what our riots are. So I have a mm-hmm. list here on what had been laid out in the Webster report, which was the Webster Commission, shortly after the riots of April 29th, 1992. So there's civil disobedience, which is the refusal to obey civil laws regarded as injustice, usually by employing methods of passive resistance. Disturbance, the act of disturbing or the condition of being disturbed, something that disturbs, break up, or destroys the tranquility of settled states of affairs, a commotion, a scuffle, especially in public tumult. An insurrection, an active instance of open revolt against civil authority for a constituted government. A rebellion, an uprising or organized opposition intended to change or overthrow an existing government or ruling authority. Revolt, an uprising, especially against state authority, an act of protest or rejection, a revolution, a sudden political overthrow or seizure of power brought about from within a given system, a riot, a wild or turbulent disturbance created by a large number of people, a violent disturbance of the public peace by three or more persons assembled for a common private purpose. And last but not least, an uprising, a revolt, an insurrection, an act or rising or an act of rising or rising up. And obviously all these can turn into a civil war. So when we talk about what happened on January 6th, that's definitely, you know, a couple old guys doing a selfie in Nancy Pelosi's office most certainly was not a riot, nor was it an insurrection. So I really wanted to clarify. And again, that comes from the Webster Commission that was the report given right after the right after what happened in Los Angeles. So.
Yeah, and of course, all the people still languishing in jail without bail, I believe, are charged with like criminal trespass. You know, none of them, I think, are charged with actual insurrection.
Well, you know, if perhaps in fear we seek an increased perception of life, you know, like the more I'm frightened, therefore, the more I exist. Mm-hmm. A lot of the things that have happened the past year, because of the lockdowns, a lot of young people were just sick and tired of being cooped up in their bugman lifestyle apartment. So it seems that the media has this ability where they kind of ratchet up people's anxieties, fears, et cetera, and then it kind of spills out onto the public square, unlike what we see in Europe, because America is – we're not really good at rioting, air quotes, right? It's never really been our thing. The LA riots was by far the most violent riot since what happened in New York City for the draft during the Civil War. I think that would be the only one that could really, really weigh itself against what happened that day. And then even with the St. Floyd riots, I mean, they're still ongoing. And when we look at the Los Angeles riots, we're talking about 30 square miles, 70 plus people dead, $2 billion worth of damage in just one small segment of the United States, 30 square miles, mind you. So and then if you want to go a little step further, it only lasted for about 2-3 days max. So this is where I'm coming from. This is like we're being habituated and tolerate certain levels of violence where now it's like the one shock video we see of someone dying, it just causes such an outrage, a hysteria, hysterics.
Yeah, well, you have a situation like where in a police arrest and there'll be a man resisting arrest and then he fights with the cop or something and he ends up getting shot or, you know, accidentally shot when the cop thinks it's a taser, like the incident in Minneapolis or Minnesota, Brooklyn, I forget what the name of the township was, Brooklyn Hills or something. I forget. But the media will get a hold of it and then run with it. And then they'll know what the reaction is going to be. But then you can also, which is evidence of this occurring in Los Angeles, 1992, but also during the St. Floyd riots is you have a complete, you have a police stand down. Police have the resources and they're trained to stop riots and they can stop it if they want and they can let it go if they let it burn out if they want. And so that's why there's some suspicion regarding LA. But, you know, of course, last year you had obvious police stand down when so much so that some of them were taking the knee or kneeling, you know, in front of these mobs. And it took on a weird sort of Maoist anti-white struggle session. On top of this, the violence. And then the media reports it as mostly peaceful, you know. At the same time, we're told that the protests weren't not anything to be concerned about in regards to COVID-19, the pandemic, because apparently racism was a more serious, public health crisis than the pandemic for a few weeks. So an anti-lockdown protest was bad. A Black Lives Matter Antifa riot / protest is good. You know.
Well, yeah, it's the never-ending signaling of the good side of anyone who isn't European also is kind of a caveat. And we also you have to realize that when it comes to the psychology, the crowd behavior behind riots, they're usually spontaneous. At least that was the case up until the 2010s, where now techno oligarchs, the ruling class, are basically manufacturing these riots, which wasn't the case in 1992, and that was one of the things that I've taken away during my research when it came to the LA riots, where, you know, now if you look at something like the Euromaidan, well, that was obviously funded by the State Department. You had the U.S. Embassy held various kind of like team group meetings with, young professionals and interns and people that are going to college on how to harness the use of social media through Twitter, through Instagram, through Facebook on how to create this type of uprising. So there are some similarities between what had happened in the past and what has happened the past 5 or 6 years, let us say.
Yeah, and you know, obviously using Twitter back around 10 years ago, you had the Arab Spring, spontaneous revolts, right? Using the internet, you know, and of course that, you know, using that way to spread the word of a protest. And, you know, of course, a lot of that was the various color revolutions that are being carried out by various NGOs, National Endowment for Democracy and Open Society Foundation and other alphabet soup, you know, organizations that are all funded, you know, by the West to destabilize those societies. And of course, then in that case, just the medium of communication suggests that there's a penetration of those societies with Western media. So it's going to mobilize those groups. But you can organize a protest to destabilize, you know, a sitting government. Then when the government, you know, reacts, it's accused of committing violence and shooting their own people, as they say. It happened in Iran, happened in Ukraine,
Syria,
Libya,
Tunisia.
Yeah.
The whole idea that it all started because of a street vendor in Tunisia started the whole uprising. Really, there's 600,000 people dead in Syria because of one street vendor, hundreds of miles away in another country. It's quite ridiculous, you know. So there are various collective psychological aspects of crowd behaviors that should be noted. Sometimes things that we would perceive would cause some kind of civil reaction is either turning into a protest or riot don't always happen. I point to like the New York City blackouts in 1977, where there was mass looting and arson.
Well, that's just like opportunistic then, right? That
right. Yeah. But then you fast forward to 2003, where the same thing happened, and people were actually partied and were out in the streets barbecuing, having a good time. I remember that. My parents were afraid that it was going to be a repeat of 1977, but that wasn't necessarily the case. 9/11 is another good one I can point to, where people acted relatively calm, cool, and collective when exiting the World Trade Center, when exiting the Pentagon. I know numerous people that were there at the World Trade Center that day, and they all told me, like, well, what? I asked them, like, well, what was it like? Were people freaking out, screaming, cursing? You know, were people rushing down the stairs? And they said, no, everyone was really calm, cool, and collective. So it's really strange how humans react to certain stimuli when it comes to a mass event such as, you know, a riot or something like a terrorist event.
Well, go back to the L.A. riots. Of course, the L.A. riots were sparked by the acquittal of the police officers. I think, if I recall, it was Lawrence Powell and Stacey Kuhn.
Yeah, well, it was four officers. The one who did the actual beating was Hispanic.
Okay, so it was a multicultural affair.
It was a multicultural affair, yes. And mine was an 82nd one. We're talking 70 people dead, $2 billion worth of damage over a video that was 81 seconds long.
Yeah, mostly this similar thing with the Floyd situation, where Ellison, the attorney general up there, the Antifa-supporting attorney general of Minnesota, released the 9 minutes of Derek Chauvin on the back of George Floyd, but no one saw the other 45 minutes where he's vigorously resisting arrest. Of course, he's a big guy, and he's freaking out. And this is, you know, that would have changed. But the media spun this narrative, and the media sparked the riots and encouraged the riots. So the media is culpable in the $2 billion of damage, the dozens of murders, the dozen of deaths, and also this, the thousands of more murders that have occurred since because of the overall breakdown of law and order and the crime wave we've experienced, which is going underreported, largely racially driven too. But in Los Angeles, in 92 in L.A., of course, Rodney King was, I think, driving at high speed. Again, how many people die a year because of the incidents like this? And they pulled him over, and he was – the videotape showed him – he was a big guy, like much like George Floyd. And he was overpowering these police officers, and they overcame. The only way you take someone like that down is to administer a beating like that. Now maybe they would have tased him. They weren't equipped with tasers back in 1992. I'm not sure. But nevertheless, that's my memory, is when you saw the entire videotape, you saw it. But again, they only saw 81 seconds, as you say, and that's the narrative that was created.
Right, and they just repeat. They just show that 81-second video clip over and over.
Yeah.
A grainy video, mind you. Mm-hmm. No pretext, no background story on who the individual was, and the media just pumping these ideas, beatings, brutality, et cetera, et cetera. And before we get so much into the beating, let's do a little pretext on what was happening in Los Angeles around this time. Is that you had a huge amount of people, whites, had already fled Los Angeles after the 1967 Watts riots. Mm-hmm. So there was obviously white flight. Immigrants came in, filled the void of the whites, and started buying up small businesses and became, relatively successful at the expense of the African-American community.
And the riots in Watts, I think that was sparked by a man another black resisting
yes,
arrest. And then a rumor spread that the police had punched a pregnant woman, mm-hmm. black woman, which wasn't true. And that sparked it, from what I recall. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. And you're 100% correct. So Los Angeles, I've never been there. And, I'm not an expert when it comes to Los Angeles. I'm from New York, so it's a very foreign land to me. I have these kind of these cool images in my head what Los Angeles is. They're probably totally wrong, but I kind of enjoy those images, mostly because of Hollywood movies, as I stated in the article. But Gary Webb makes a great point about the Bloods and Crips in his books, where the cartels from Colombia were running a very well machined operation, funneling drugs into California with the help of the Mexican drug cartels and the Bloods and Crips as their proxies to distribute the drugs. So when the African Americans didn't really have their own business, they didn't really, they weren't really being all that entrepreneurial, they turned to crime. Mm-hmm. When that was happening, Daryl Gates, who was the police commissioner and the longest tenure police commissioner in Los Angeles Police Department as chief, he had to figure something out, and that he created SWAT. And that's where we kind of got the rise of the paramilitary, where you started seeing police officers using APCs, flashbangs, various tactical gear.
This is special weapons and tactics, I think, stands for.
Correct. Yep, yeah. Special weapons and tactics. And that was kind of going on in the 80s.
Well, so this is funny because I'm old enough to remember in the 1970s, when Aaron Spelling, the producer of Charlie's Angels and these things, these 70s, 80s shows about detectives and cops, they produced SWAT, a TV series. In 1975, it premiered. And this was right after the assault and burning down of this house, the safe house of the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yes.
The people that had kidnapped Patty Hearst. And, of course, their roots go back to Vacaville Prison, and they were a product of Operation Chaos. It was a CIA front. And the thinking that is that they were spawned to create a pretext to create a militarized police. And so you had that shootout, and this became a justification for SWAT. And then there's Hollywood there to produce these TV shows. And this sells this idea to all the various cities around the United States that every city, any police department that's serious is going to have a SWAT team, And then the ball starts rolling with contracts and everything. So that's the context, the SWAT team. I remember it became became cool, and there were shows glamorizing it,
Well, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly when Daryl Gates thought up the idea of SWAT with the help of some others. And Daryl Gates, Irish Catholic, born and raised in Arizona. He was part of the Parker faction, which was kind of this, I want to say, meat and potato, all-American type of guy. The police headquarters at that time was named after the Daryl Gates' mentor, which was police commissioner Parker, who also coined the term the thin blue line. That mm-hmm. now you see with the whole Blue Lives Matter flag, stay behind the thin blue line. That was coined by the person who basically mentored Daryl Gates, who initiated the concept SWAT. So a little bit of a little factoid for you, useless bit of information. So Daryl Gates, he was very pragmatic, by the book, wasn't all that religious, kept religion to the side, unlike his a deputy commissioner, which I'll get into shortly. But it was interesting because I read his biography and he was kind of, you know, waxing and waning the ideas on how nice Los Angeles was in the 1950s up until the Watts riots, where a police officer, he had a shotgun in the back of his seat, but he never really used it. You can walk the beat, check on some hooligans that robbed from a candy store. You know, it's like like a Lou Rockwell painting or something like that. So he realized that the demographics were changing. You had a huge influx of Hispanics, especially Mexicans. You had it became more multicultural. It became more diverse. And once it became more diverse
– and more violent.
That really set the pretext and premise for creating a more militarized – police force.
Well, isn't that almost like the oligarchs, the Jewish oligarch strategy? Is you create a multicultural environment, which then creates a violent society, which then necessitates a police state. You know, when you have a high trust homogenous society, you don't have a problem.
I mean, exactly.
Was he wrong? I mean, if you look at it, was he wrong? That's my point.
The paradox of diversity, my friend. So that, you know, you also had what was going on in the late 70s with all these serial killers. Again, the mass hysteria. Don't trust your neighbor. Don't go outside. Lock your kids indoors. You know, don't talk to this person or that person because they might be the night stalker or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he was dealing with a lot of these different, ongoing, general societal mistrust, let us say, in Los Angeles. And then you started building up high rises. Obviously, the more dense the area is, the less likely you are to trust your neighbors, the more likely you are to start walking around late at night, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Things really started to change when the Olympics came to town in 1984. The overwhelming majority of the populace supported Daryl Gates. I mean, he wouldn't have been the longest tenured police commissioner in LA if they didn't like him. There was a commission board that appoints the commissioner for the LAPD, unlike in other cities in the United States where he's appointed by the mayor. So there was this idea that you don't politicize the police department, and Daryl Gates really emphasized that throughout his career. You don't want to politicize the police, period. Once he resigned in late 1991, that obviously all changed. But back to what I was saying about what was going on during the Olympics. Well, if we were talking about the JQ, what happened was in 1984, he had an intelligence report that the Soviets were planting KGB agents through the Jewish quota, or I'm losing the words, but when becoming a U.S. citizen through immigration, the KGB was using the back door to push these agitators through the United States. And he became aware of this and presented to the Olympic Commission. And he says in his book that things changed when he brought that up, saying that, hey, listen, there's KGB agents who are hiding underneath the Soviet Jew quota for coming to the United States. And I thought that was quite interesting because not only did he say that, but it was echoed by his deputy commissioner, Vernon, that things changed after Gates made that statement to the Olympic Commission.
So that he started, things started to happen behind the scenes against him when he
– Correct. There was a purge. There was a purge of a lot of people on the LA Council after he made that statement. I have it written down. Just give me one second here.
That's interesting. That's a bit of intrigue I wasn't aware of.
Let me see here. Give me one second here. Sorry about that. So the wave of immigration came, and when he made that statement, and when he brought that to the Olympic Commission, he was actually going to get a promotion to become head of security for the Olympics around the world. So whether if it was in LA, he would be brought on to handle the security for another Olympic in whatever city around the world. And they brought up that he was being anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, I'm just stating the obvious that there's obviously KGB agents reported from intelligence. It's not him being biased or anything like that. He was just making a point that we have to be aware of Soviet agitators.
Yeah, but just because he had mentioned that they're using, I guess, the Jewish cover, they accused him of being anti-Semitic. Because,
that's correct.
Yeah.
So there was obviously purge at that point. I'm sorry, I just can't really find what I had written down regarding that. But regardless, I'm looking here at some of the people that were part of the council at that time. You had Zev Yarlotsky, City Council District 5, which is the most affluent area of LA, and he was a devout Zionist. He was part of the Habonimi Labor Zionist Youth Movement, which preached that thing that Dr. E. Michael Jones talks quite a bit about. It's some Yiddish word where they have to go around promote peace around the world.
Oh, Tikkun Olam, repair the world.
Yes, that's correct. So he was part of that that youth movement. And Zev Yarlotsky also headed out for the deputy commissioner, Vernon, for being a born-again Christian. So they started pushing Vernon, asking him, are you okay with homosexuals being in the LAPD? Do you have a problem with that? Will that interfere with you doing your job as a police officer? So Vernon was going to be the replacement for Daryl Gates when he resigned, and Zev Yarlotsky didn't want him to be the next commissioner because of his deep Christian faith. And what was interesting about that is that he countered Zev Yarlotsky and sued him for violations of his religious rights, and the judge tossed out the case and didn't even want to hear it. And he found that to be a real turning point in the United States, where if I'm being attacked for my religious belief on the grounds of me just being a Christian, or if I don't believe in this, that, or the other, what kind of society we're going to be living in another 20, 30, 40 years or into the future.
Yeah, well, he got his answer.
Right. That's right. So there was also Joel Walsh, a gay graduate of Harvard, Hal Branson, who was also wanted for – he was quite corrupt. The ethics board was on him right up until the end of him resigning. Marvin Brarud, who was also another one of your friends, let us say. and then there was also Michael Wu, who made the inflammatory remarks to Gates on TV, where Wu was questioning if – the city doesn't side with Gates or if the verdict on King doesn't go the way the LAPD wants it to go, are you saying that the LAPD is going to stand down? I don't know if you've ever seen that video, but it's in a very important video.
Hmm. So he was, foreshadowing or foreseeing riots or unrest. And,
correct. Yeah. And, I'll get into that in a moment, but Michael Wu took the seat from Peggy Stevens in 1985. Peggy Stevens was a diehard supporter of Daryl Gates. And that, again, this coincides with what happened with Daryl Gates' statements about the KGB agitators. So they purged Peggy Stevens in 1985, and Stevens blamed a West Side political organization headed by U.S. Representative Henry Waxman and Howard Berman for her loss. Now, Michael Wu had connections to a bunch of Asian banks because of his father. So when you talk about West Side political organization, you talk about Howard Berman and Henry Waxman, who are also part of the tribe.
Yeah, that part of that sort of California mafia.
So you see things start to really go against the LAPD shortly after the Olympics, and that seemed to be a serious sticking point for the LAPD.
And I guess this also, again, you mentioned, coincides with the sort of the ongoing culture war, because all of a sudden now you have, like, for some reason or other, gay rights becomes an issue relevant to, like, the police force. You know, how many gay cops are there going to be? You know, whereas 10 years prior, that would have been a ridiculous question, even in liberal California. Now it's how many transvestite cops you're going to be, how many tranny cops you're going to have. And so that becomes an issue. And also the idea that a believing Christian can't not hold a public office because of if he's not suitably or
if he's not down with the gay disco.
Yeah. If he's not at the gay disco, he's not an enthusiastic supporter of gay rights, then he can't hold public office, you know, because you're a Christian. And that's like, well, can we say, you know, that's like saying, well, what if we turn that around? Instead of, if you're Jewish, can you hold public office? They would cry anti-Semitism. But that's what E. Michael Jones would call Jewish privilege. And now, you know, the typical Christian with the typical pedestrian Christian beliefs now is more or less a second class citizen, because his beliefs, moral beliefs, are now go against the current zeitgeist or the new dispensation. He's now the deviant, you know.
Well, it's funny you brought up the homosexual aspect of things. You know, in March of 1991, they had a gay pride march, and the deputy chiefs kind of stood down because the homosexual parade started acting quite rambunctious. So they started protesting. It turned into political theater one way or another. And the deputies stood down and did not enforce the law. And Daryl Gates pulled them all into his office, stating, "Well, what's going on? Why weren't you enforcing the law?" And he realized right then and there that the tides were turning against him, and people were kind of jockeying for his position. And that became a bit of a foreboding on what happened during the LA riots, where he realized that his subordinates were not going to be enforcing the law on that night.
Mm-hmm. I guess by force line, I mean like public decency laws, which are often violated at such events, which no one seems to enforce. Yeah.
Well, the deputy commissioners were also jockeying for his position. They were looking to become police commissioner also. So they were more than happy to throw Daryl Gates underneath the bus during the night of the 29th.
Oh, that's interesting. So basically, again, it's an old story. Basically, is public safety, the welfare of the city is thrown under the bus, cast aside for political ambition. That's not too surprising, I guess.
Right, and you know, he tried to make a point not to politicize the police force. That was his idea. So these deputies, these subordinates, realized that you have to play politics in order to get this position going forward. There was no longer a standard. It became a face-to-face interview. It was no longer a book test, more or less. It was no more written exam, let us say. Mm-hmm. It was more of a front like, will you adhere to woke ideology going forward for the LAPD? Will you abide by some type of diversity quota, et cetera, et cetera?
And you mentioned this in the article where, the backdrop or context for these riots, you had a mayor, I think it was Bradley at the time, who was embroiled in a lot of scandals.
He was the first African-American first African-American mayor for L.A., and I think also the longest tenured up until this time. And he was being investigated by various bodies. The attorney general at that time was Ira Rayner, who was also the attorney general for the McMartin school scandal. I know that's
– Yeah.
So was the judge, I should say, for the Rodney King, Judge Stanley Weisenberg, whose first case was the McMartin preschool trial. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So Ira Rayner, who was the DA, not the attorney general, the district attorney of Los Angeles at that time, he was also kind of pushing the whole diversity quota, et cetera, et cetera.
But you have someone like Bradley, then I think he's the one that made the statement regarding the verdict and, you know, I guess more or less convicting the police officers in the eye of public opinion, and sort of that's very similar to what many public officials and politicians did with the George Floyd incident.
Yeah, he kind of was the catalyst of the whole riots that night, similar to what Trump had done. Except Trump threw his own people underneath the bus, more or less. But that's a topic for another day. So the Rodney King beatings happened. You had an 81-second video. Then you had something called the Christopher Commission, which is there's quite a extensive detail on the Christopher Commission, where they basically started investigating, overturning everything that was going on the LAPD. They destroyed the intelligence aspect apparatus of the Los Angeles Police Department, so they were unable to really get any type of intel and figure out what was going to be happening shortly after the riots. The commission highlighted the problem of repeat offenders on the force, finding that approximately 1,800 officers against whom an allegation of excessive force or improper taxes was made from 1986 to 1990. More than 1,400 had only one or two allegations, but 183 officers had four or more allegations, 44 had six or more, 16 had eight or more, and had 16 such allegations. Generally, the 44 officers with six complaints or more had received positive performance evaluations that failed to record sustained complaints or to discuss their significance. So the Christopher Commission was headed by attorney Warren Commission, who later became U.S. Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. They went through everything with a fine-tooth comb, and they came up short. The report basically stated, kind of these feel-good talking points, but most of the report composed of things that the LAPD was already doing, like community-based policing, et cetera, et cetera. They went through 6 million police transmissions, and the commission found 277 conversations that were not politically correct. Of the 277, 44 racial slurs. Of the 44, 28 were from one officer. Of the 28, 12 were about blacks. The committee also couldn't decipher what was locker room talk and police jargon. The thing that bothered Gates was the data in the report. When he asked where the data came from, they denied his request for references. They denied his request for the references, and the LAPD was not allowed to give a public rebuttal for the Christopher Commission.
So there's allegations of racism, brutality on the LAPD. I guess people aren't going to be too surprised or to be shocked that there might be, you know, some legitimate cases there, of course. And there was an issue of corruption within the LAPD. I mean, you have the Rampart scandal. The role, I think, some deputies or some cops were actually involved in playing the role of bodyguards for drug dealers, you know.
Well, they were called the Vikings. They were part of the LAPD. The Sheriff's Department had this kind of this neo-Nazi-esque faction called the Linwood Vikings. They had something called the Cult Commission that looked into the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to see exactly what was going on there. I didn't really do too much research on that aspect of things. There was some type of element of that going on in the LAPD. I'm not here to deny any of those type of things. What's also fascinating is who was on the police commission, which was a Stanley K. Scheinbaum. He was one of the five members of the police commission. On the police commission, there was one Jew, one white woman, one Japanese American, and one Mexican American. The one white woman on the police commission founded Women Against Gun Violence, which was helped created by feminist Betty Friedan. Now, Stanley Scheinbaum's an interesting character because he was part of the Malibu Mafia, which was an informal group of wealthy American Jews who donated money to liberal and progressive causes throughout the 1960s up until the early 1990s. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Stanley Scheinbaum was notorious for hugging Yasser Arafat. He was part of the ACLU. He was the Southern California's ACLU chairman and was the chairman of the California Human Rights Watch.
Yeah, there was Ron Unz ran an article a while back about organized crime in America, and he talked about the Jewish mafia out in California, and sort of in their role, or at least their position within the California's political establishment, and how some of these wealthy families had made a lot of money off the property that had been seized by the Japanese in 1942 after Franklin Roosevelt's executive order. The Pritzkers are one who are very powerful now, of course, in Illinois. The governor, J.B. Pritzker, is a scion of that family. Henry Bazelon was a judge that Truman appointed. He was part of that Jewish mafia. And he, before he became a judge, he distributed a lot of that property to a few of his associates, fellow tribesmen, and that became the basis for this vast wealth. But one of the he in that article, Juan Unz surmises that one of the reasons why wealthy Jews in California, Henry Bazelon became has a reputation for it being a liberal judge, very concerned about civil liberties and such, is that he wanted to, if you're engaged in high-level criminality and plundering, you want a lot of street crime because that's going to get the attention of the public and it's going to take attention away from your high-level, thievery. And so you create a lot of unrest and street crime to divert it, attention away from it. And one of the things was like ordering the mental hospitals open, promoting civil liberties and that limiting the police ability to crack down on crime. And so, it's the same way that the Jews had gotten behind the civil rights movement to use it for their purposes, kind of take it over and use it for their purposes to actually create more unrest and weaken the majorities, the majority population to serve their interests and sort of get under and kind of co-opt it, take it over. And so that's an interesting theory there because what's suggested here is that there are certain elements that want to create turmoil and unrest in society, whether it's, through cultural issues or promoting crime, these things to disrupt normal society. There's one of the things that Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about is that she sees a lot of this rioting stuff as sort of a real estate acquisition by those in power.
They work in tandem with one another to create these mm-hmm. type of opportunities, let us say. Going back to the judge, journalist Stanley Weisberg, he was also the one that thought up the idea of moving the Rodney King trial to Simi Valley. Well, why would you do that? Everyone was kind of in agreement that it should be held in a relatively diverse location and mm-hmm. represent the demographics of that area. Why would you go ahead and move it to someplace like Simi Valley, which was well over 90% white at that time? The same goes for Latasha Harris, which we didn't even get into, was that judge, which she was a immigrant from Venezuela whose father was an executive for Hollywood.
Yeah, that was the case where she was shot by the Korean clerk.
Yeah, that's correct. Joyce Carlin was the judge's name, and she was a Jew, and her father was a wealthy movie studio executive. And the agreement from the jury was give her the maximum sentence. It's clear as day this woman committed murder. Why would you give her probation, a slap on the wrist, a $500 fine, and 400 hours of community service? And I don't know if you've ever seen the video of the judge reading the verdict, but it was kind of this in this vein of I sympathize with Du. Like, what? We should be more empathetic towards the ones that committed the crime, so on and so forth. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was very disturbing, and that really caused some serious animosity between the Korean and African American community. So you have two judges really instigating for some type of mass protest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. This is also occurring with in L.A. when the blacks are being nudged out by Mexicans and those from Central and South America, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing with the African American community is that they needed to express themselves one way or another. It was a cry, as I wrote in the article. They had no way of venting their frustration because they were losing their city. Mind you, the blacks came to L.A. shortly after World War II. They had to obviously go to factories. Again, Dr. E. Michael Jones covers this mm-hmm. extensively in his book Slaughter of Cities. So they, as you outsource and offshore jobs, they lost power. The only power that they were able to garnish was through the Bloods and Crips faction, through money laundering, through crime, through gangbanging, et cetera, et cetera.
You also have the culture revolution in the 1960s and the breakdown, the expansion of the welfare state and the meltdown of the black family.
Right, all those things coincided for crime to skyrocket, crack epidemic. Never forget, Los Angeles acts as a weather vane for the rest of the United States. So if there's a crack epidemic in Los Angeles, you can rest assured it's only X amount of time before it reaches places like Las Vegas or St. Louis. You know, obviously New York City also plays a factor into acting as somewhat of a weather vane in the direction of the United States.
And the drug market, the drug markets are pivotal in America's financial system. and a lot of that money went into financing not only rap labels, but were financed through American banks. And of course, Gary Webb's Dark Alliance series exposed the role of the CIA in facilitating the importation of cocaine into places like California. And there's Freeway Ricky Ross, who was set up by the CIA, and I think it was Jose Blandon was his name. But he was able to get cheap cocaine, from I guess Colombia, or I guess was it the Medellin cartel at the time?
Medellin.
Yeah, so he's set up, and then he develops crack cocaine is a cheap form of cocaine for blacks who don't have the money who don't have as much money as Hollywood celebrities to snort cocaine, the powder, and it's marketed as such. And then, of course, then the media starts to say there's a crack epidemic. It's 10 times as powerful and 10 times as cheap. That's a commercial.
Well, also that the crack people caught with crack or selling crack are sentenced much harder than those caught with cocaine,
mm-hmm.
which obviously doesn't help African-American causes when they're getting thrown in jail for longer periods
I think Joe Outlaw was talking about how crack cocaine was developed was it Stanford University, a lab or something?
Yes.
So
baking soda or something.
So there you go. I mean, so then, they don't have to, like I said, they don't have to control. Once it leaks out, they can, the information how to do it can disseminate rather easily, and market forces will do the rest. But at the same time, all that money, again, of course, it's capitalizing U.S. banks, people's 401ks, and that's what Catherine Austin Fitz writes about, in how Wall Street's funded by this stuff. How, she has that one about the president of the New York Stock Exchange flying down to Columbia and meeting with the FARC, the revolution group down there, who funds their operations through drug dealing. He wanted them to invest their funds in Wall Street, and they said, "No, we're going to keep our money local." And then Plan Colombia went into effect, and there's a crackdown in Colombia.
So. Well, you have to realize that automatic weapons were still legal in the United States around this time. Mm-hmm. So when you're having gangbangers receive an unsurmountable amount of funds from the Colombian drug cartel, course, what do you think the reaction is going to be from the LAPD? Well, you're going to start militarizing the mm-hmm. LAPD. So you had all these different factions going on leading up to the riots.
But I'm saying no one's going to have a serious crackdown on the Crips or the Bloods or the drug dealing, because that's a profit center. So whether it's for weapons or for drugs, there's no interest in stopping the gang wars nor the flow of drugs, because it's again a source of capital for American companies, particularly the banks.
Well, I made a point in the article about how the early 90s you saw a major crackdown on any type of organized crime. In New York City, for example, that's when the Italian-Americans started really losing mm-hmm. their foothold in New York, was when the RICO statute started coming about with the help of Rudy Giuliani. It was actually quite hilarious watching Rudy Giuliani crash and burn, because of the people that were probably in his best interest to protect him, he already purged 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's like, well, you got rid of the one faction that may have, supported you to kind of act as somewhat of a counterbalance towards this type of organized crime, which we're witnessing now in the United States. You got rid of them. No one's in your corner backing you up anymore. So you had all these things happening in the late 80s and early 90s, whether it was the Italian mafia or the African-American Bloods and Crips, there was some type of power vacuum happening. And I find that the LA riots was a great accelerant to push forward a new type of culture, policy, basically taking the country in a different direction, which no one really knew at the time where it was going.
Yeah, I think what happened was after the 1960s, the five-family model organized crime had served its purposes, and now it was going to be corporatized. And that's what you saw that in Atlantic City and Las Vegas, where the corporations sort of took over and nudged aside these families, these crime families. And so the real organized crime, the most powerful organized crime faction, crime factions, shut them down because they're no longer useful. They served their purposes, you know, after the 1970s.
Yeah, that's a pretty good pretext on what led up to, the LA riots. Going back to the riots themselves, and this is something that you tend to bring up quite often, is the whole kind of the insurance scam aspect of things. Mm-hmm. One thing that's kind of something that's to point out is that most of the rioting in LA happened during the daytime. It didn't actually happen at night. And I thought that was kind of interesting. So the riots really only happened the night of the 29th and really fizzled out by May 1st. So you only had a time span of 48 to 63 hours of absolute bedlam, where it was anything goes, carnival atmosphere. The veterans of the riots and the LAPD often refer to it as Mardi Gras. So I thought what was interesting about the whole thing is the amount of fires that had happened. And Daryl Gates made a point that he found it to be somewhat opportunistic for a lot of corporate entities to basically scorch earth policy, destroy all these businesses, clean the books, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that's something that you and Atwell have brought up time immemorial the past year.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, if you can claim the insurance, you burn the building down and get rid of the inventory and claim it all, or not burn down, get it out and sell it out on the black market, and then still claim it was burned down. That's one way to a lot of money. It's also, if you want, I don't know, was there like a destruction of a lot of small, family-owned businesses, and then in its place, you saw. You mentioned the article where one thing you noticed with the Koreans is that you had people defending their property because it was theirs. And with this riots last year, you didn't see that because everything's corporately owned. No one has an incentive to protect their property because it's corporately owned. So there's a change in the culture because as everything becomes more corporatized, no one has an individual stake or concern in their own business.
Well, absolutely. I know during the St. Floyd riots in New York City, they all happened on like Madison Avenue. Mm-hmm. And places that are kind of these commercial zones. No one actually lives there. And I made a point during one of my live streams a couple months ago that no one's going out buying a $20,000 Rolex. No one's going to these very lucrative boutique shops spending $50 up to $500 on a t-shirt or sweatshirt. No one's going about buying these very expensive consumerist goods. And I found it interesting, the timing of the St. Floyd riots, because even prior to 2020, no one was really shopping at these very high-end stores.
Yeah, so you have sort of the retail apocalypse where these stores aren't moving their high-end goods. All of a sudden, you have a riot and looting, and now you can claim it on insurance.
Well, Gates said in his autobiography, when he was ruminating on what happened during the riots, and this is, I'm quoting the book now, "I've always been skeptical of experts," air quote. "We arrived to analyze a riot after the fact. I always believed the burning was intended to cover up the looting. No one would ever know how much was stolen and how much was destroyed by fire. Many markets were not individually owned businesses, but chains owned and run by people from a distance. So some stores had credit accounts. So I had a feeling also the burning was designed to wipe out debts." Not only did he say that, but it was, again, echoed by many other people in the LAPD hierarchy, that that is exactly what happened. I have also here from the Webster Commission a view from the LA riots, July 1992. This is from a small shop owner. I'm a 60-year-old Jewish white male. He calls himself white. Born and raised behind my store at 510 South Central Avenue. My roots of yesteryear and up until April 30th, 1992, my life revolved around my business and relationships with friends and customers who living around my store. After the Rodney King verdict came down, all bets for a peaceful city ended in LA. By late afternoon, people were pulled out of their cars and beaten, robbed, and license was granted to loot and steal and burn. The media claimed that these criminals were a tiny fraction of the population. This I do not believe. During the initial looting and burning, it became obvious that the police had instructions to lay back and stop nothing. Lessons from the Watts riots and any riot I have ever seen in any country around the world were not even considered. One tear gas grenade thrown into a store full of looters would have hurt no one, but the store would have been empty and safe. Tear gas is a weapon that was not once used against these mobs or criminals who were destroying years of work and sweat and family traditions. My first notice came when my burglar alarm went off in my store at 3 a.m. The alarm company called to let me know their normal procedure was to call the police, but the police were not taking any of these calls this night. Whoever broke into my store stole several guns and little else. I thought I was saved. By 7 a.m., I met with my employees who are black and had no fear of going into the area. They spent 2 hours boarding up and chaining entries closed. By 9 a.m., they spoke to me and announced that schoolyard half a block around my corner was loaded with National Guard troops. The media claimed that they would be deployed by late morning. Again, I thought I was safe. By 3 p.m., a neighbor called to tell me that about 100 looters were in my store. My prayer at that moment was that they burned the store or all would be lost. By 4 p.m., I was called and told that my store was an inferno. The police never stopped once, and the fire department arrived 2 days after the fire. 2 days later, I walked through the ashes that were still so hot that my soles of my shoes came apart. I burned my fingers trying to open my floor safes. The flames kept popping up all around the floor, and I was 2 days later. This was 2 days later. Unbelievable. I lived through the Watts riots and the stores burned, but not completely. Inventories were sold with smoke damage. In this riot, every store that burned. I burned to nothing. It was burned to nothing but ashes. I believe the whole thing was planned and special incendiary devices were used. He goes on. Let me continue here. Neighbors who witnessed the looting and burning told me about a car with three white men jumping out, breaking open my doors and waving to a truck full of Mexicans to come loot. They then took off and went one block and did the same thing to a cleaners and took off. The sporadic nature of the looting and the fires around the city certainly smells of conspiracy. The only major stores that were hit the hardest was Pep Boys and the Thrifty Drugs, who I have heard were in financial trouble in the ghetto areas. So I wanted to bring that up because I thought it was quite interesting how he's insinuating that there was three white men, agent provocateurs perhaps, going around instigating for the Mexicans to go about into these businesses and start the looting. What's also interesting during all this is that they also gave all the small businesses SBA loans. Whoa, isn't that interesting? Didn't all the people that also witnessed some type of hardship during the COVID epidemic receive SBA loans? Mm-hmm. They did.
Yes.
So it was also quite interesting is that no police officers were killed during the LA riots, unlike the Watts riots. So the looters and the rioters never really opened fire upon the police. Who did they open fire upon? The fire department. Why was the fire department the target and not the police during the LA riots? They were shooting the firefighters to keep them back from putting out the fires. It's so. What's also kind of a crazy story is that when the head of the fire department, when he showed up to one of the biggest infernos that day on April 30th, he showed up and everyone was clamoring around his car asking this, that, or the other. He actually popped open a bottle of champagne and started drinking it. Everyone was looking at him like, "What are you doing? why are you drinking champagne while the city burns? And he just started laughing. just craziness.
Well, it is. I mean, we saw maybe a similar thing occur last year with, as you mentioned, in Madison Avenue, New York. All these corporate shops are looted. You have, again, these business districts in Minneapolis burned out, businesses ruined. Is this a sort of a real estate acquisition strategy? And it was Catherine Austin Fitz who did a study and located. She found out that most of the riots were occurring in cities where there's an office for the Federal Reserve. And she had a software program that identified as such, but she's saying these are what's called opportunity zones. And if you are planning to install, a smart network or smart cities, one way to do that would be to provoke these riots, destroy the property values, and then all that real estate, commercial real estate, can be bought up at pennies on the dollar and redeveloped according to whatever plan you have. So someone like Jeff Bezos can step in after the fact and buy up huge tracts of property to build Amazon, fulfillment centers or even smart grid infrastructure. So that would explain why last year you saw the stand down. The pretext is the George Floyd incident and the ensuing riots. But that didn't explain throughout the country. Public officials, public safety officials, police chiefs, mayors, just standing down, and of course then the media narrative is that it's mostly peaceful, black protest when we could see it was rioting, it was looting, rioting, and with Black Lives Matter. And of course this Antifa groups, which
was the shock doctrine. I think Naomi Klein's book about how we go around the world and initiate these type of mm-hmm. incidents, and it's kind of I wrote in the article, it's like a low grade shock doctrine. And if you were to look up who is acquiring a lot of commercial spaces in New York City right now, well, it happens to be Facebook, Amazon, the Fangs, Netflix. I don't know if Netflix is, but I can definitely attest that Tesla, Amazon, and a lot of these multinational corporations seem to be in the thrall of it all, buying up all these REITs that are in financial ruin.
And of course, the lockdown or the other supposed containment measures for the pandemic have bankrupted the family-owned smaller businesses, the retail business that would otherwise, the brick and mortar stores that would compete for market share with Amazon. But if they don't exist, Amazon doesn't have to compete. And of course, the people, if they're locked down and they don't feel comfortable or it's no longer convenient or enjoyable to go shopping, and I've done this myself, you order online because it's just no longer, you can't browse anymore. You can't have an enjoyable day out because of the mask mandates and capacity restrictions and all the collective insanity you see out there. So in a way, even someone who's aware of the op is in a way forced to even to promote it because normal life is just disrupted in a way it's no longer enjoyable to even go to a brick and mortar store and shop and patronize them anymore. But if you have the juice to the influence to stage or carry out a false pandemic and with all the supposed containment measures, which lock down businesses, keep businesses shut down, you will be in a position to pick up the slack and take over. And that's evident. If you look at if you study real estate acquisitions and if you study, look at how much wealth a handful of billionaires have made in the past year, their wealth has soared. Why? I think it was it like 27% per quarter? The billionaires, whereas the middle class have lost about 30-40% of their collective wealth. you know.
Or you paper over it. Again, bring up the SBA loan aspect of things, which is something I found kind of
which is debt.
Disturbing. It was really disturbing how many people were so excited about getting an SBA loan. Oh, I got approved for $500,000. I go, but you're in ruins. Yeah, but I got $500,000. Yeah, but you have to pay that back.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of papering it over so as a way of covering what's really going on. So let's say you do take that SBA loan and the PPP protection, the PPP loans. Sure, you're papered over it for a year and a half, 2 years. But if there's this constant shutdown, mm-hmm. All right, now you have these odd curfews, et cetera, eventually someone's going to come along and say, hey, listen, you know, you're shot. I'm buying you out. And sure enough, it would most likely be a hedge fund or a larger REIT.
Yeah, it'll be BlackRock or Berkshire Hathaway or something.
Well, I brought up Berkshire Hathaway in the article because weren't the bricks that were supplied to the rioters provided by Acme Brick Company, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is something quite telling. Again, yeah. And you also have the insurance angle of all this. So who insurance companies are also insured themselves. And that was something that came to fruition that I was kind of like unaware of, a bit ignorant about during the Hurricane Sandy. Like, who's going to bail out these insurance companies? Well, it's a bigger insurance company.
A bigger, bigger, bigger insurance. It all goes back to the Bank of International Settlements. So they can just create money out of thin air. You know, that's like what's happening with the real estate, residential real estate, is that you have outfits like BlackRock that are buying up entire developments of homes. And they're competing with individual buyers that's driving up the price of the home. But they're playing with house money because they're given trillions of dollars from the Federal Reserve to buy up assets. And so... And when you have like things like lockdowns with the economy shut down, they're papering it over with $1,400 checks here and there, bailouts, but they're destroying about maybe 10% of the economy a year. So within a decade, you're not going to have the old economy is going to be gone because
they're keeping you on life support.
Yeah. You know,
and hoping you get that $1,400. Well, when are we getting another $1,400?
Mm-hmm.
And you see the media promoting. Oh, when do you expect your next $1,400 check? Well, it's in the works.
Yeah, that's conditioning people for UBI, and at the same time, it's hard. How do you get employees back to work if they're getting, $1,200 a month in unemployment and benefits? But again, you're seeing the debt skyrocket. You know, the stock market is high, but the retail economy is dead.
Well, during the St. Floyd riots last year, once the rioters left these downtown commercial districts, you know, again the Madison Avenues, the Garment district. I mean, I don't even think there is a garment district anymore. I think it's just all LGBT bars at this point. But the Diamond District, mm-hmm. let us say, as soon as they kind of started spreading out and getting into more of like the small businesses, you know, the Hispanic owned bodega, mm-hmm. the Indian restaurant, the shoe cobbler, which there's still quite a bit of in New York, they got squashed really fast. I remember they tried getting to the Queens Center Mall. And the rioters stood no chance because they met with such vitriol hatred by basically immigrants who have their whole lives dedicated to this one little corner store. And that was – you saw that during the L.A. riots. Again, the whole based rooftop Koreans that we wax poetics about.
Yeah.
But, it was just the Koreans, because the Koreans had no place to run, no place to hide. There was no Korean flight, air quote. 36 Korean shop owners were killed prior to the L.A. riots in the past 3 years. So they had a bit of an axe to grind with the African-American community.
Yeah, well, yeah, their stores are – every day they're targeted for shoplifting and violence, and that's just I guess that's Chris, that's Asian hate, right? So but one thing you didn't get with the LA riots, was with the George Floyd riots was with the George Floyd riots, you had this I alluded to earlier, there's sort of this nationwide anti-white struggle session, which is continuing, which bespeaks, I think, something else, or maybe we're at a different phase now, where now there you see this final, maybe the demographics are lending this way, but leading this way, but the idea of the war on heritage or white America, for lack of a better term, and it's become open war, open season on white Americans.
Well, the rule of law is white. And that's something that I took away while doing a lot of this research on the LA riots. It seemed to be that somehow the police represent white identity. And unfortunately, we've kind of – a lot of whites have fallen for that with the whole Blue Lives Matter aspect of things, not realizing that you're supporting your captors. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was kind of sad seeing those protesters on Capitol Hill waving Blue Lives Matter flags. I'm like, you are aware you're probably going to get arrested by the people you're supporting.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something about the anti-police or defund the police thing, where, of course, that's just a strategy to get rid of local police to usher in maybe federal, even international policing, where, you know, we need – they're not doing away. They want a new type of policing, you know, not doing away with police. It's their type of police, sort of a revolutionary, maybe a Cheka or something, want to come in and replace the local community police. But at the end of the day, it's the local police are going to come in and arrest you for not wearing a mask, keep your business shut down. And then you have this Derek Chauvin incident where it's either you're an Antifa BLM or white liberal, you know, guilt-ridden white liberal protesting with them, or you support the cops.
You know? Right, it's one or the other.
It's one or the other. It's sort of this black and white, or, you know, sort of this one side. Pick a side. It's a bit more complex than that. And this is where, like, I would say that the public, the American people, and more specifically Heritage America, they're in a pincer movement now. Because you have this, the whole this COVID nonsense, and you also have the anti-white racial nonsense, where this you've had all this agitprop now, where they really stepped it up in the past few years. Trump really accelerated it. You know, he didn't but the reaction
during the
Trump
LA riots, you did witness, as I said earlier, the paradox of diversity. So when you had that that window of no police, well, everyone it just became you know. Every race and every ethnic group, each is to their own, sort of speak. So the Koreans versus the African Americans, mm-hmm. it was all out, you know, attack on any white man that was left in South Central at that time. You saw what happened to Reginald Denny, who was just a wrong place, wrong time, blue collar truck driver who got savagely beaten by by criminals, by outright criminals. All four of those people had some, you know, troubling histories.
Well, one was eventually murdered or something in jail.
One was killed in a strip club. Yeah. One was a crackhead, and two wound up in jail.
Same thing with remember the Bernard Goetz incident where
the subway vigilante.
Yeah, where the assailants later on couldn't. They had since been. One was already in jail. One was already shot dead. You know, but one thing is, you take something like you know, the Rodney King incident with the police, or with George Floyd, is we're told that a singular incident like those, it speaks of a systemic problem in society. America's, you know, irredeemably racist. This something needs to be done. The system needs to change. But then when you have, incidents of black crime against the Korean store owners, or of savage, you know, crimes committed against white Americans by blacks, it doesn't bespeak a societal or community problem or a racial problem within that group. It's they're just oppressed. And the reason why they are committing these crimes is because it's something that's been done to them or hasn't been done to them. They have no agency. They're not responsible at all for themselves.
Well, a lack of decorum within the African American community,
which is promoted, by the way. And again, it is promoted by media and certain tribes that own the record labels and all that. But it does. There is a lack of introspection, so to speak, that's born out of a sense of entitlement and also sort of it's oddly, it's almost like you're put on the throne of being a victim, because in America, being a victim is power. And so they
look who's being attacked right now. Well, it's anyone of Oriental descent being attacked by African Americans. Yet somehow it's white people's fault that that's happening.
Yes.
This is crazy. And again, that somewhat echoes the LA riots, where there was an attack on the Korean Americans who are Orientals. I also want to bring up the fact that the Attorney General at that time was William Barr.
Yeah.
Who was also the Attorney General under Trump during the whole St. Floyd, George Floyd riots.
Yes, yeah.
And him and Bush also called for basically the public lynching of those four LAPD cops.
That's right, because they brought a federal case against them eventually, yeah.
That's correct. The whole military aspect of the LA riots is something that
so much for double jeopardy. Yeah, well, it's a federal case. You committed a federal crime, you know. It's like...
Well, they initiated the Insurrection Act for the LA riots. Mm-hmm. There was Operation Garden Plot and one executive order that slips my mind, but I have it in the work in the article. But none of those things really mattered, and the military, what their role for the riot was quite unclear. The worst atrocity that had happened during the LA riots is when the U.S. Marines opened fired upon on a single family dwelling with a Hispanic family where it was a domestic dispute. The LAPD was being shot at by whoever was inside that house. They were taking shotgun rounds. They started opening fire when they were going to knock on the door. One of the cops said, "Cover me," to the U.S. Marines. Now, U.S. Marines, they're not trained to handle domestic disputes between two drunk couples squabbling over whatever. They interpreted the cover fire to literally opening up suppressive fire, and they put 200 rounds through that house where I don't know if they wounded the individuals inside, but the cops were asking the Marines, like, what the hell was that about? I just wanted you to make sure I was okay, not actually open fire on the people inside home.
This is the problem with militarizing the police, or introducing the military into domestic law enforcement, because it's two very different missions. And you've had this fusion with the 1033 program. This is born out of the drug war. Police have access to weaponized or military hardware, their tactics have become more militaristic. So now we have that. But but this was foreseen back in the 60s with Garden Plot. It was almost like they were chomping at the bit to justify military intervention into domestic situations born out of the 1960s and the black riots and the anti-war protests. Again, this is that dialectic, and nowhere is it ever considered that maybe the protests have a legitimate beef, or maybe meet them halfway, or see what the issue is to infiltrate them, radicalize them, make them more violent, so you delegitimize the movement in the eyes of the American public. At the same time, you further militarize the society, which you had in the 1960s. That's what Garden Plot largely was, which Warren Christopher was a part of back in the late 60s.
That's correct. Yes, he was.
Yeah.
It's crazy how all these characters intertwine one way or another.
Yeah, I wonder why we'd never get our problems solved. I mean, they only leave when they're being led out by their feet. They don't, they don't step aside and let someone else, maybe they should step aside now. But again, at the meta level, the powers that be have no interest in solving these problems. In fact, if anything, they want to create more discord and unrest, because that's where they get their power, and that's where they, out of chaos, a new order. And we see that with the Great Reset and all that, where they're trying to implement, Agenda 21 through the pretext of a pandemic.
Well, no one asks, how do we come this far? Why, as much as the left likes to bash and make fun of the 1950s, it was no fun in the 1950s. Well, I ask my grandparents, when was the best time of your lives? What was the most fun? They all say the 1950s. Well, what were they doing? They were screwing, having children.
No, but they were married.
They were married.
And having sex when you're married just isn't fun. You got to be at a rock festival in the mud doing it or something. You know, or a bathhouse or something. That's freedom.
I'm sorry. They just seem to really bash any type of normal.
No one was having sex during the baby boom. Come on.
No. I don't have 20 uncles and aunts. No,
it's ironically people are. I mean, it's, well now they're not. They're not interested anymore, from what I understand. Look at this polling.
Well, Gates was part of the Greatest Generation.
Yeah.
And he really put an emphasis on how much better it was being a cop in the 1950s and early 60s. Granted, he was a bit of a bureaucrat. He was a pencil pusher. He was Parker's personal driver, which is how he learned how to become a police commissioner, just mm-hmm. listening to Parker and watching how he interacted with the public and local politics. But he made a notion that it was, you know, there was times when I didn't even really need to carry a gun in the 50s and early 60s. And during the Watts riots in the late 60s with that hot summer, you know, that seemed to got the ball rolling where, wow, things are really changing and I'm going to have to really start, you know, coordinating myself in a more, I guess, militaristic manner, let us say.
Yeah. Yeah. And when he was talking about Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s and the demographic changes, which created the conditions for the riots of the 60s, there's something to be said for that, meaning that if you do bring in, you know, if you do have an immigration policy or you do have a policy of busing people in or shipping people in, you know, through, you know, like they did in the 40s through the 60s.
Busing rioters.
I mean, Michael Jones in Slaughter of Cities writes about that, how, you know, it, under the cover of urban renewal and racial integration, these neighborhoods were destroyed and that these homogenous neighborhoods, which were functional and prosperous in many ways, were completely destroyed. And, you know, and for those who said, you know, they're going to bring in the blacks and destroy the neighborhood. Well, it did destroy the neighborhood. Were they wrong in the full context of things?
I think with the LA riots, in the full context of things, I think the African-American community certainly had a grievance, and it wasn't necessarily against.
Well, they've always had grievances. I'm not disputing the grievance, but the problem is the powers that be, the narrative we've been given with the civil rights is that wasn't there to address those grievances, there to exploit those grievances and aggravate them, as we see now.
Yeah. Well, public perception of a situation are usually out of sync with reality. Mm-hmm. And even this past week, wasn't there was like a where LeBron James tweeted something about a cop? I mean, the cop saved a young woman's life.
Yeah, there was an incident. And this is, I think, where they've gone too far and they might have to pull it back a little bit, because I think a good 2/3 of the country is suffering from Negro fatigue at this point. They're just sick of it. No, I mean, in little, you know, yeah. But this 16-year-old girl.
15
pulls a knife and is about to stab to death another black girl, and this cop saves a woman's life, and then they try to make an incident out of it.
After we just got done dealing with St. Floyd.
Yeah.
So it's just it's going to be just constant at this point. Now, obviously, there was a huge lag between Rodney King to where we are today, but it seemed that the template has always been that type of you know, that's basically the template in which the ruling class uses, where you get this small little clip of a cop on a black man's head, or of a grainy video of a person high on PCP doing 110 miles per hour down a freeway, mm-hmm. and all bets are off. You just the hysteria. Where again, I really bring up the whole violent aspect of things. We're talking 70 people dead during the LA riots in a less than a week span mm-hmm. time frame, and I don't know what the death toll is for George Floyd, but we're kind of just become a society of hysterics. We're being hysterical about COVID over a handful of grandmas dying in a nursing home.
Yep.
We have to lock down people under the age of 40 who already are struggling, in debt, living in their parents' basement, which Hillary Clinton seems to make fun of quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is pretty sinister. And I really do think this is the darkest time in the United States history.
Well, look what they've done with children and masks. They're not letting children breathe. I mean, did you ever think you'd have to, like, having the right to breathe would be a political issue? controversial.
Well, they're going to tax that if we get the Green New Deal.
Well, they do. I mean, that's what the whole carbon thing is. We're carbon-based life forms. So if there's a tax on carbon, they're taxing your existence. Because at the end of the day, they don't want carbon-based life forms. They want sort of the transhuman, you know, silicone-based life. You know, that's
what being a bug man in a 200 square foot apartment with Netflix and pornos.
Yeah, and that's their vision. You know, that's an optimistic vision, because
just going back to the LA riots. You know, once the riots simmered down, they had the Webster Commission. And by 1993, anybody that was affiliated with the riots in politics and in the police were purged. And from there, we kind of ushered into this new phase, which I believe is somewhat of the Silicon Valley aspect of things, where they started putting their roots in and started really developing some type of infrastructure. And that's where LA is today.
Well, which maybe it's interesting you say that, because that's what Catherine Austin Fitz theorizing it might be occurring in some of these other cities, where the riots destroy the property values, which then can be purchased and then redeveloped according to retooled according to the Green New Deal or the Great Reset. And if you follow, she's a money person, so she follows the investment patterns, and you can kind of prove it forensically that way. You know,
will you
follow the money?
I think it was in the one of the number nine, the communist plank part of the manifesto was to redistribute the population, where the cities, the population of the cities, kind of just migrate outwards. Where now, I don't know what it's like by you, but I can tell you where I'm at. You see more of these low level, high density, low rises.
Yes.
You know, like 3, 4, 5 story apartment complexes, mixed use, where you got to have like the local tavern at the ground level, the Pilates studio, the kind of like this half-assed restaurant with the bistro lights, given this like kind of this hotel living where the downtown is your living room, so to speak. And that's what I'm seeing now. Where, okay, eventually maybe down the pike they'll loosen the restrictions, but your whole downtown, your local suburb is going to be redeveloped and revitalized to something that you're just not used to or acclimated to.
Yeah, and that's the whole part of that Agenda 21 thing, where they simply don't maintain the roads or the infrastructure to make your typical suburban house viable anymore.
Well, sodomite on a bike sharing programs. Yeah. Electric cars is another aspect of these type of things where, hey, listen, if you want to go visit the Rocky Mountains, well, if there's no recharge station out there, you ain't going there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all part of corralling humanity, creating these massive green spaces or only the elite. Look what they've done with commercial flights. You know, they're creating a situation where commercial air travel for the typical person won't be feasible anymore. At the same time, Bill Gates is investing in private jets.
Private jets, and now is the largest landowner in the United States. Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I haven't really confirmed that among.
I heard it was 250,000 acres, and of course, and he's trying to also monopolize food production. You know, so we can eat, fungus burgers and insect.
Cricket tiki masala. Yeah.
You know, at the same time, everyone, and he's also wants everyone learning remotely, he knows it all because he's got he's a college dropout who, made money selling software, apparently. So.
And he's not a doctor. How did he go from, software production to vaccines
is a
whole other. Whole other tangent I could go on, knowing who his father is. I mean, that alone should scare the daylight out of the normie con, knowing just a little bit of research. Just use Wikipedia, find out who his father is. If that's not enough to tell you not to get the vaccine, I don't know what is.
Yeah, well, someone who actually wants to reduce the human population involved in immunization and vaccinations. what are his motivations? But again, a man, he wears pastel sweaters, so it can't be all bad, right? So.
Or his wife having the crucifix upside down as a necklace. That's normal.
Yeah, that's normal. But again, these are the creeps that we've enthroned.
So because they make money.
The sad part is we're never really going to be able to know what the actual death count is for both the George Floyd, Saint Floyd. I want to be correct saying the word saint because he is a patron saint at this point. But same thing goes for the LA riots, where there was never an official body count. There was many instances where they kind of downplayed the severity of the riots that day. Yeah. I have one instance in Aaron written off. A 6-year-old white male died Friday, May 1st, 1992. He was strangled to death by a supermarket produce manager in dispute over a corn husk. Now, he was not originally part of the death count, but then they included him in the death count because they stated, well, would he have gone shopping at that market if it wasn't for the riots? He probably would have gone to another supermarket, but that one was obviously being looted. So they kind of played with the numbers quite a bit during that time. And I don't even think there is an actual an official count because of what has happened the past year. And we'll never really get to the bottom of it, unfortunately.
And, you know, if you want to count, who knows? I mean, when you have a breakdown in law and order and you have a spike in the homicide rate, I mean, do you count those? I mean, since last year, there's some cities are experiencing 30, 45, 50, 60, 75% increase in homicides because of the breakdown of law and order and the de facto police stand down.
Right. So do you include those people in the riots? And that's where we kind of get lost in the numbers with a lot of these different
things. Look at Chicago. I mean, there's the breakdown of the rioting that occurred in Chicago, looting. And then, you know, I mean, they'll make an incident out of, you know, there'll be an incident where the police shoot someone who's resisting arrest or he dies in custody, one person. But over the weekend, there'll be 16 people shot to death in Chicago on the South Side. Not a peep. No one cares, you know.
Yeah, that's for certain.
One thing we also know is that rioters are caused by – I mean, riots are caused by rioters. I'm going to get too complicated.
Well, it takes a handle. Usually yes. The people that engage in the riots are – usually it's – one, it's the people that initiate the antagonism, whether agent provocateurs or not. Yeah. Obviously now they most certainly are, and they're well-funded. Some of them are paid. I've seen Craigslist ads for these people to go about and doing these dastardly deeds. But the thing that also is like, who would in their right mind would want to be a cop in this day and age?
Yeah.
All the good cops are retiring. I know with the NYPD right now, there's never been such an influx of people looking for an early retirement. They've pulled back on overtime. They already don't get paid that much. I think starting salary for an NYPD cop is like either $35,000 or $40,000. So what is that? That's, you know, after taxes, you're walking home with like $400, $450 bucks. And if you got to use mass transit, you know, that's $120 a month out of your pocket if you live in the boroughs. And if you live either in New Jersey, Connecticut, or Long Island, you're looking upwards of $300 to $400 in just transportation. And you still need to have a car.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, you know, places like New York, which had sort of a renaissance in the late 90s and aughts, it's because you had a very heavy police presence in certain areas, which used very harsh tactics to keep the crime low.
And stop and frisk, which they did away.
All these, you know, arguably authoritarian measures. But if you're dealing in a low trust, diverse community, you're going to have those. Otherwise, because then the community doesn't police itself. You need those measures. And it is a result of forced multiculturalism.
Well, you know, New York City is, I think, considered the most diverse location on the planet. There is a prevailing ethos. And actually, my first article I wrote for the American Sun titled "I Want No Part of It, New York, New York," I kind of go into a little bit of a detail on how there is still a prevailing ethos and how to act. There's a level of decorum. It's funny, if you go on a New York City subway, everyone dresses black. So part of that, I'm like, wow, there's still remnants of New York where people still abide by a certain code of conduct, let us say. But there is a hierarchy within ethnic groups, depending on where you are. And the average white American who's from, you know, wherever, you know, Omaha, Nebraska or whatever, wouldn't really understand those those levels of hierarchy. You know, obviously Indians don't like Pakistanis, Pakistanis don't like Bengalis, Italians don't get along with Albanians, so on and so forth. And there's always kind of a movement of the tiers on who's kind of, you know, more or less running the show. You know, obviously the Jews run quite parallel to a lot of these type of things, but the Chinese seem to be the one that seem to be really putting their mitts into a lot of these major cities, buying up properties. And we're experiencing this type of petty Maoism, you know, where, you know, if you're a doctor, it's because of your privilege. Therefore, the janitor should be a doctor. I'm like, well, how does that work? Well, that comes from China. I mean, the Soviet Union never did anything like that, nor did the Soviet Union ever really play games with the genders.
No.
So there's a lot of other nations that see the decay of the United States where, one, they're probably looking at this as an opportunity, and two, they're probably looking at this like, wow, this country's lost its mind. You know, maybe we should start, you know, building up our military or something.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, okay. Well, where can people find the article?
The American Sun. Please check it out. I work pretty hard on it. I'm going to keep researching the topic. I'll probably do a couple of live streams on it in the next couple of weeks. Tim, I really appreciate it. I love talking to you. I love your show. Keep it up.
No, thank you. Okay, so they can find you. This is at the MGTOW Chats.
MGTOW Chats. We're over on BitChute, and we are on YouTube and MGTOW.TV.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Have a good one. Thank you.